going to bust some of the really critical temperature thresholds that literally will not be compatible with human life. So this is the fact that we really do need to get acting.
Welcome to Understory, our weekly focus on the environment. My name is Elizabeth Poe. Today, Understory brings you another from our Climate 2018 series. We return to the still unaddressed issues surrounding climate change and health in Western Australia. Public health and mental health, and the impacts of rising temperatures and changing climate on vulnerable people in our society, the young, the old, the sick, those living in already hot climates around the state, and those who live in cheap housing without insulation, unable to use expensive cooling if they have air conditioning at all. There's mounting evidence from other parts of Australia that a lot of psychological pressure is felt by farmers, firefighters, medical teams, emergency services, and businesses affected by erratic shifts in climate. These are the people who are vulnerable to climate change as temperatures rise and significant pressure will divert infrastructure to keep up. Understory travelled to Canberra last month to speak to the Climate Change Institute at the Australian National University to learn more of the details about climate change and health impacts.
Greetings, I'm Dr. Liz Hannah, formerly of the National Centre for Epidemiology and Population Health here at ANU, but currently with the Fenner School for Society and Environment and the Climate Change Institute in an honorary capacity. I was part of a group that set up the Climate and Health Alliance and was president of that for 6 years until recently. And that is concerned people working within the health sector, recognising that we could use our voice as a powerful lobby group because we are a trusted voice in the community, to be able to get the message through to our policymakers, our politicians, that climate change is a human health issue. So as far as human tolerance to heat, it's a lot easier for those who are in the colder climates, except for the problem in when they have extreme heat for them, and they succumb, and they have been succumbing in very large numbers, which I've been calling mass death events. And that's the 2003 in Europe and the 2010 in Russia. But for Australia, we're having increasing days over 35, increasing days over 40, over 45. And some recent research is basically suggesting that the big cities such as Sydney and Melbourne are likely to be hitting 50 degrees in the not too distant future. How quickly that happens, of course, depends on how much the world rolls back its carbon emissions. And unfortunately, we're not doing it anywhere near with the sense of urgency that it does. So how it affects people. We have an upper level of temperature that we can survive. We can maintain our core temperature. A major issue for Australia as far as climate change is concerned is the increasing heat. Recognising that Australia is already hotter than many other countries of the planet. In fact, our national average temperature is about 13 or 14 degrees hotter. So when we're considering that the world is warming and has already warmed 1 degree, well, we're already ahead of the curve. So it's not only people keeling over and dying because of extra heat strain. It also means that people, I mean, the response is lethargic. And so how are we going to keep working? Australia cannot shut down throughout summer, but we can't keep pushing people till they keel over and die.
Well, the Europe 2003 experience was quite salutary, wasn't it? Because it wasn't so much that the temperatures were objectively hot, but people weren't experienced at that particular heat level. Can you talk us through about how the Europeans really did fall into trouble then, and the Russian example as well?
Yes, that's... It was way outside their normal pattern. So not only physiologically were they not acclimatised, and I can get onto that in a little while, but their behaviour, they weren't prepared for it, and their building design. If you think about the housing design, all those multi-storey buildings which are their apartment blocks, and they're there to conserve, designed to conserve the heat. And so the top floors of those were in excess of 40 degrees, and hence the fact people were dying clearly because it was there was no heat exchange and it was very, very difficult for them.
And people not knowing to wear hats and stay in the shade, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and one of the key things to protect is staying fully hydrated. And as a race, you know, most people tend to run a little bit dehydrated. And it's really important, the most simple message is to make sure that people know that they need to keep drinking. And by drinking, we don't mean beer or coffee or wine. And to keep drinking until, to make sure that they're urinating multiple times throughout the day and that it's very, very, very clear. If it's not a very light or clear colour, then they need to drink more.
So can we talk about the specificities of public health risks in Australia, around the continent, that you would expect in the next 20, 30 years? Maybe it's already happening in some places. What are the public health risks particularly?
Key one, of course, is, again, heat, as we've been discussing. So there will be problems in terms of how do we cope and how do we manage maintaining active workforce? And that includes also the essential services and how we're going to staff those, manage those, because if the essential services keel over, society suffers. So these are the, you know, the ambulance, the district nurses, the people that go out and keep the electricity running. So when those, because those transmission lines, the cables themselves stretch. And so you can have power blackouts purely because even the electricity infrastructure gets too hot. So if we have massive power blackouts, then people's air conditioning is not going to work. And so it's educating the public in terms of what they need to do to keep themselves cool, and to factor in the fact that the ambulance might not be working, the traffic lights can be out, the roads can start melting, you might not have power. And so what we used to do in hospitals years ago was we'd, when we did have power, of course, would wet sheets and put a fan under a wet sheet to make a little wind tunnel, or even just putting wet flannelettes on the, you know, on your chest and behind your neck. Those sort of simple strategies, and the world nowadays really does need educating. We're also very concerned in terms of preparing the health sector, and so not only do the public need to be educated about heat, and this includes children, in recognising when people are hot, at risk of overheating, and what the first aid is required. But we also need to prepare the health sector so that they are fully on board. And this includes things like the specific medications that people are taking that interfere with their thermoregulatory system, staffing. Staffing the emergency units because, for example, when Melbourne had their heatwave and then they had repeated heatwave, ambulance, people had to wait 8 hours for an ambulance and people died because the ambulances were taking too long because of the massive explosions. So public health, we need to factor in how we're going to manage these emergency situations and so that all the sort of emergency and essential services actually get to the people.
Mid last year, the Labor government announced a sustainable health review. But the health department did not mean sustainability in the common garden sense of the word. They meant, as they came to explain, only financial sustainability. And at the beginning of 2018, despite environmentalists and public health advocates expressing concern, what did their Sustainable Health Review interim report say about climate change? Nothing. In early 2018, Understory spoke to Dr. George Crisp from Doctors for the Environment.
Yeah, Sustainable Health Review. It's being run by the WA government. It's in the process of taking submissions and they're just about to put out a report. The idea basically is that our health service is unsustainable and we need to make it sustainable. The focus of it initially was very broad and it was truly about the sustainability of how you do it.
Yep.
What's happening is that it's being narrowed down to economic sustainability. And we're trying to basically get them to take on board the fact that if you don't think about environmental impacts on the health service, on the population and other social factors, forget sustainability because that's going to swamp it.
That's right.
So this is actually a key moment in time in that they're actually setting the sort of scope of this at the moment, and the first report is about to come out in the next couple of weeks.
Wow.
So,
and where would I find it?
If you just look up Sustainable Health Review,
yep. Okay.
On the government website, they'll know all about it. Yeah. Yes, it's important.
And so Doctors for the Environment, they'll be putting in submissions.
We've put in a submission.
You have put in.
The question is whether they will take any notice, because our submission actually could be sort of deemed to be outside of the terms of reference as they make it more just economically focused.
But you're requesting that it actually be.
But we're basically saying, well, these are economic issues. Yes. If you're, there's a limited amount of money, you've got to respond to all of these other things that are happening. Yeah. If you start having, big heat waves that knock out, the elective surgery for a week, that's a big economic issue. How do you deal with the waste? How do you deal with this? It's a bit of a roundabout thing. Is that what we'd like them to do is look at sustainability more broadly in the health service. But we may not be able to do that without going through a somewhat economic vantage point to do it. Climate change is costing us in health, all these things are costing us in health. The health service has got to respond and it's got to be resilient.
That was George Crisp, who's on the National Committee of Doctors for the Environment. Back in 2013, a federal Senate committee visited different parts of Australia to learn about the impacts of climate change, including health. And what did the Barnett government provide for the committee? Nothing. Here's understory reporter Adrian Glamorgan speaking to then-Greens leader Christine Milne in March 2013.
Another aspect of climate change coming out today is the impact of climate change on public health. It's actually one of the great untold stories at the moment of the awful impacts extreme hot weather means that people have to rely more on air conditioning. And it means that the people who are in lower socioeconomic groups, the poorest in our society, are the ones who really struggle to pay their bills. So what you have to do here is recognise there's going to be a big cost to the health system, there's going to be increased loss of life. I'm really disappointed that the state government made no contribution to the hearing on the extreme weather events. This is a critical inquiry because it's looking at the gaps. It's saying, are we prepared for the extreme weather events? And if we're not, what do we actually need to invest money in to be able to help? And we've had some really constructive suggestions. We've just had emergency services in the Northern Territory talking about the importance of getting the mapping done so that they can anticipate cyclone strength, for example. In other parts of the country, we've had health systems talking about things that they need. And yet here in Western Australia, we not only know that Western Australia is not prepared and therefore the government's not protecting its communities, but they're not even prepared to come and explain themselves or even comment on what they're doing. What we're interested in is what are the emergency services able to do here in Western Australia? What can we do to protect communities? I had a terrific meeting with mayors down in Bunbury yesterday. They were talking about the concern they have that local government doesn't have the money to adapt in the way that they need to, and they're worried about who's going to end up being financially liable.
That was the then leader of the Greens, Christine Milne, in 2013. Since the beginning of the year, we've had two automatic replies to our email requests through an interview with the Minister for Health and Mental Health, Deputy Premier Roger Cook. Today on Understory, we're reviewing inattention shown by state governments in Western Australia to strategies in public health impacts of climate change. That the McGowan government still hasn't got a climate change plan organised.
So that's a major one, and there's many others, but we'll talk about that in a moment. And that's from the droughts and fires and the mental health issues that follow after those.
Indeed. In fact, mental health issues for people in, say, remote or rural areas where their livelihood is being affected and their health, it must mean that we need to resource extra services for mental health.
Yes, that's definitely true. Now, we've got the statistics on the spike, particularly in male suicides that happened with the millennium drought. And if you sort of think about Australia's climate has always been, bizarre, really, highly variable. And so all the farmers, and many of these, of course, are multi-generation. Their father and their father's father has survived. And when it goes under on their watch, it's absolutely soul-destroying. And so they feel as if they're a complete failure. And particularly even some of the rural areas where people aren't necessarily coming to terms with this is the new norm and it's going to get worse, then they're struggling against the odds without making the sensible planning decisions in the fact that this is what they're going to need to prepare for. So they could be easier on themselves and the community, and expectations could be easier on people in recognising the fact that they are battling a really, really difficult challenge here. And it's not a personal failure if your farm starts becoming really difficult financially. And so another thing that the country needs to do is to support our rural industries, because we can't, you know, and a total exodus of rural communities would be bad for the nation, not to mention the families themselves. We need to be self-sufficient in food.
And I suppose farmers have to seriously consider whether or not they change what they grow or where they grow to head south.
Yeah, that's already happening. Certainly, particularly in the crops that have a very tight climate niche, such as grapes. And so they're already moving down to Tasmania, and they're moving higher up the up to higher altitudes to do that. Wheat is a really big important crop in Australia. Wheat is very heat sensitive, and so again, that's something that we need to start thinking of. Do we, you know, switch over to crops that are a little bit more heat tolerant, such as some of the lentils and chickpeas and such?
Remember, if you or anyone you know needs help, you can ring Lifeline on 131114. Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36 or Headspace on 1800 650 890. That's Lifeline, Beyond Blue or Headspace. I'll just ask you about one more demographic, and that is older people and vulnerable people. What special issues are there for public health services?
Yes, there's big issues, of course, because, again, getting down with thermoregulation, it's not as effective in the elderly, and certainly also in the very young as well, which is another reason why they're so problematic. And indeed, people with what we call is comorbidities, so they've got another health problem, particularly cardiac or renal. And, of course, the elderly people can often have cardiac problems, they can often have a little renal impairment as well, might not be switched on as well in terms of making those sensible decisions. And the other thing also is that elderly people have been shown to feel as if they're sort of fully hydrated when they're still very, very dehydrated. So if left to themselves, they won't drink enough. So supports for the elderly people, again, is alerting them when we're going to have heat events. And it's not just telling people it's going to be hot. It's making sure people have the options of what's required to do to protect themselves and keep them cool. And the other group I was thinking of mentioning also is that the Youth Coalition, the AYCC, and they're a wonderful group. So whenever I go out to schools, encourage them to join the AYCC so that they're thinking about it in the way that youngsters think about it. And if people find that it's so big and it's so overwhelming, then that's very negative for their mental health. And also we know psychologically that people feel better if they are actively engaged in working towards a solution rather than being sort of overwhelmed by these external forces that, you know, it's all bearing down on me and I'm powerless, I can't do anything about it. That's very, very bad for the mental health. And so we very much encourage everyone to get involved in various groups, set up groups, get active, and be part of the solution.
Thanks to researchers Dr. Liz Hanna and medico Dr. George Crisp for speaking to Understory. As we look down the public health microscope to learn more about the effects of climate change on public health. When we speak about the state climate strategy as it applies to health, we must remember that the McGowan government came into office without a state climate strategy. I'm Elizabeth Poe, and along with Adrian Glamorgan, we'll be back next week, same time, same station, same planet, when there'll be more to explore on your Understory.